content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Work and Money section of the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include Inflation Fears Missing for a Decade Hit Stock Markets and Planning Ensures Nonprofit Success and Consumer Agency Looks to Shed Aggressive Style. And we'll begin with Inflation Fears Missing for a Decade Hit Stock Markets. Investors have finally detected the whiff of inflation. Whether it lingers is the debate now underway as stocks and bonds slide worldwide amid concern that prices are set to accelerate after their post-crisis lull. Though inflation still looks under control in most major economies, pressure is building, and there are legitimate reasons to say its return is relatively near. That could force the Federal Reserve and fellow central banks to tighten monetary policy more aggressively than anticipated, meaning a sharper end to the era of easy money that swaddled markets for years. There is clearly a worry about inflation, and there is a follow-over to worrying about interest rates and bond yields. James Bevan, Chief Investment Officer at CCLA Investment Management, told Bloomberg Television. With those concerns spiraling and volatility surging, here are some of the cases for and against an inflationary revival. The first one, global demand. The International Monetary Fund predicts a global economic expansion of 3.9% this year and next, which would be the fastest since 2011. It's synchronized, too, with growth picking up last year in 120 of the countries it monitors, which altogether accounts for three-quarters of the world's output. Such an environment means firms should be more confident about passing on cost burdens to customers. At J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, economists led by Bruce Kasman say a shift away from global goods price deflation is gathering steam. Capacity constraints. More demand leaves many industries running into supply limits, handing them another reason to raise prices. IHS Markits, Global's measure of purchasing managers' indexes, rose at the quickest pace in more than 3.5 years in January, and many of the companies it tracks reported a squeeze on resources. Wages. Workers may enjoy greater bargaining power as labor markets tighten, though that's a development that's been forecast and failed to materialize many times already. A source of the stock sell-off was Friday's news that U.S. average earnings rose 2.9% in January, the strongest gain since 2009 and reflective of a 4.1% unemployment rate. Germany's most powerful labor union just agreed a new pay deal, which, according to one analysis, equates to an annual increase of about 3.7% this year and 4% in 2019, both well above inflation. In Japan, where cash earnings likely rose just 0.5% at the end of 2017, the labor union is also demanding a raise. A caveat is that higher wages still might not translate into faster inflation. If so, the traditional relationship between falling unemployment and faster inflation, as epitomized by the Phillips curve, may remain broken. Unemployment rates relative to past lows may be understating slack, implying that any steepening of the Phillips curve may therefore not be imminent, even in economies with low unemployment rates, said Ben May, an economist at Oxford Economics, in a report on Monday. We still consider the upside risk to our inflation forecast in the advanced economies to be small. Commodity prices. Oil has been caught up in the latest market rout, which has fallen from recent highs, but it's still up almost 30% in the past 6 months. Gains may continue in the medium term, supporting inflation. Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated and Morgan Stanley are among those who've recently raised their price view on the back of recent OPEC output cuts. May at Oxford Economics again says second-round effects from higher energy prices may not occur, meaning the impact on inflation would be temporary. China. While China's industrial reflation has been a major reason the world hasn't slipped into deflation over the past few years, prices are predicted to moderate this year. And even though consumer prices are on the rise, a strong yuan is helping to keep a lid on import cost and domestic inflation still contained. President Donald Trump's first major legislative success came in the form of a $1.5 trillion tax cut, which could end up juicing inflation, too, if it further spurs the economy. And next, planning ensures nonprofit success. When residents of Central North Carolina are trying to rebuild their lives, the Barnabas Network helps them create a home. The Greensboro-based nonprofit provides used and refurbished furniture to individuals and families recovering from addiction, homelessness, abuse, fires, and other challenges. Arriving at the nonprofit last May as its executive director, Derek Sides was charged with significantly expanding Barnabas's reach and impact. It was a big task, but Sides also had a major advantage over many nonprofit leaders in similar situations. A substantial evaluation report that Barnabas had commissioned in 2014. Developed by UNC Greensboro's Nonprofit Evaluation Support Program, the evaluation explored how Barnabas's services impact its clients and how it can improve its performance and sustainability. As he transitioned into his new role, Sides says the 30-page report, completed a year before his arrival for less than $1,000, offered a perfect window into where the organization was and what our current challenges and opportunities are. It helped form the basis for our strategic planning. The report had recommended that Barnabas develop a strategic plan, as well as enhance its marketing through more consistent messaging and stronger funding. Data analysis in the report also helped Sides and his colleagues spot important patterns, such as the fact that Barnabas tends to get its largest number of referrals for people in need from June through December, meaning it needs to build up inventory in the spring. With funding tight, demand for services up, and the new federal tax law expected to have an adverse effect on charitable giving, nonprofits everywhere are increasingly under pressure to show results. Learning how to use scarce resources to do effective evaluation is really going to be important, as well as communicating with funders to gain their support for evaluation as a critical business function. Foundation, says Jean Tedrow, president and CEO of the NC Center for Nonprofits. But the barriers to evaluation can be formidable. Innovation Network's 2016 State of Evaluation report found that 85% of nonprofits said they need evaluation to know if they are being effective, but just 28% had what the study termed promising capacity, a blend of the internal knowledge, tools, and time to undertake substantial evaluations. The vast majority of nonprofits do not have the funds to hire external evaluators, and even those that do sometimes hamper themselves by evaluating the wrong things. A vicious cycle ensues. Too often, nonprofits find themselves without the resources or skills to invest in evaluation of their operational performance and impact. But without solid evaluation data, it becomes harder to attract the investments needed to expand and evaluate their work. How to break this spiral? First, nonprofits need to ask themselves, what is the difference we are trying to make, said Meredith Emmett of Third Space Studio, a Durham nonprofit strategy consultant whose clients include Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, Foundation's Nonprofit Leadership Academy. Because they are eager to drive change, nonprofits frequently try to do too many things, making meaningful evaluation difficult. Once there is a specificity about what success looks like, it's then critical to identify measures for gauging progress. Those measures can't simply be the province of a few leaders. They need enthusiastic buy-in from the board and staff and need to be communicated frequently. Tracking progress against those measures requires a third step, collecting the right data. If a nonprofit isn't asking the right questions of itself, its clients, and the communities it serves, it will not get the data it needs to keep improving. And that's what evaluation is for, getting organizations to be more effective and efficient, said Morgan Fleming of The Good Evaluator, a Durham consulting firm that has assisted Don't Waste Durham, Triangle Area Parenting Support, and other nonprofits. In addition to independent consultants, whose fees can range from a few hundred dollars to $15,000 or more, depending on the scope and complexity of the work, nonprofits can also benefit from regional support programs. Hands-On Northwest, North Carolina, with funding from the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust, offers a measurement consulting program for as little as $200. WNC Nonprofit Pathways provides free organizational assessment tools that can help nonprofits explore critical questions. Once nonprofits have a solid system for measuring success, there's one more stage, communicating their impact to clients and fundraisers so that it's easier to attract more resources and generate more results. For nonprofits passionate about making a difference and fighting for resources in a competitive landscape, that should be the fun part. And this column is by Christopher Gergen. He's the CEO of Forward Cities, a founding partner of HQ Community, and author of Life Entrepreneurs, Ordinary People Creating Extraordinary Lives. Also, Steve Martin is chief of staff at the Nonprofit Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro. They can be reached at authors@forwardimpact.info and followed on Twitter at C. Gergen. And next, consumer agency looks to shed aggressive style. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau last year sued four lenders affiliated with a Northern California Native American tribe, alleging their costly loans violated interest rate caps in more than a dozen states. The enforcement action came amid a probe into yet another high-interest lender, World Acceptance, which the federal watchdog was considering accusing of consumer protection law violations. Months later, the agency issued tough regulations aimed at reining in the practices of payday lenders, including limiting the number of costly short-term loans they can offer to cash-strapped Americans. But since the start of this year, it's been a different story. The Bureau asked a federal judge in Kansas to dismiss its case against the tribal-affiliated lenders, ended its investigation of World Acceptance, and said it may reconsider its payday lending rules. Welcome to the new CFPB under White House Budget Chief Mick Mulvaney, appointed by President Donald Trump in November to temporarily lead the Bureau after the departure of Richard Coldray, who had been appointed by Barack Obama. Between the bevy of recent moves by the Bureau and the launch of a wide-ranging review of its practices ordered by Mulvaney, a picture is emerging of what a Trump-era CFPB will look like, and it appears it will not resemble the agency that developed a pugnacious reputation over the last 6 years. Mulvaney outlined his view in a memo obtained by news site ProPublica, criticizing the Bureau for being overly aggressive under Coldray and saying it would now serve not only consumers but the financial services companies it was created to regulate. We don't just work for the government, we work for the people, and that means everyone, those who use credit cards and those who provide those cards, those who take loans and those who make them, those who buy cards and those who sell them, wrote Mulvaney, a free market advocate who once called the CFPB a sad, sick joke. For Lauren Sanders, Associate Director of the National Consumer Law Center, such a mission statement simply means unwinding consumer protections. I think we'll see a lot of rollback, she said. For now, the practical implications of the pullback appear to be limited to the agency's more aggressive interpretations of consumer protection law. The lawsuit against Golden Valley Lending and other firms owned by the Habermalil Pomo of Upper Lake Tribe is an example. In that case and others, the agency relied on what industry attorneys have described as a novel argument that lenders broke federal consumer protection laws that forbid unfair, deceptive, or abusive practices by collecting on loans that carried interest rates higher than state laws allow, in some cases as high as 950%. In other words, the argument goes, the Bureau piggybacked on state laws to allege a violation of federal laws. Saunders said dropping the case looks to her like a clear sign that Mulvaney, who accepted contributions from high-interest lenders while serving in the House of Representatives, plans to go easy on players in that industry. Mulvaney, in 2016, was one of a group of House members who argued in a 2016 letter to Coldray that federal regulation of the payday loan industry ignored states' rights and would cut off access to credit for many Americans. He seems to have a sweet spot for predatory lenders, Saunders said. But Ori Lev, a partner at law firm Meyer Brown and former deputy enforcement director at the CFPB, said the Bureau could be dropping the case for other reasons. When they first brought these cases, the criticism was they were federalizing state law, Liv said. But it's not clear if Golden Valley was dismissed because of the novelty of the claim, because it was a payday case, or because of the involvement of Indian tribes. Scott Pearson, a partner of law firm Ballard Spayer, who represents financial services companies, said he expects the Bureau will focus on cases in which firms are accused of practices such as overcharging customers or charging illegal fees. That could leave the door open to more actions like the one the CFPB took in 2016 against Wells Fargo and Company. The Bureau and other regulators fined the San Francisco Bank $185 million for opening checking, savings, and credit card accounts without customers' authorization. Likewise, there is an expectation across the board that the Bureau, even as it seeks to pare back rules created under Cordray, will write some new ones. In his memo, Mulvaney indicated that rules for debt collectors are high on his list of priority, while also suggesting rules for prepaid card firms and payday lenders are less important. And next, in volatile times, tech stocks often bounce around the most. In a week of stock market volatility, technology companies such as Apple, Alphabet, and Facebook saw some of the sharpest declines. Economists aren't particularly worried or surprised. That's because in shaky times, technology stocks often take the first and hardest beating. Most of their value is based on what they will become in the future, said Lawrence Harris, an expert in stocks who teaches at the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business. And the future, of course, has not yet arrived. Stock market volatility is tied to investor confidence, Harris said. When investors are feeling bullish about a company or an industry, they buy stock, which drives up values. When investors feel pessimistic or skittish, they're more likely to sell. So, when it comes to the technology industry, where valuations largely rest on what companies might be able to accomplish in the future, investor pessimism can lead to significant swings in stock prices. Facebook, for example, is a money-making machine. It made $40.6 billion in revenue during its 2017 fiscal year. Still, its market cap is $523 billion, more than 13 times its annual revenue. To warrant such a valuation, investors must believe that the company is capable of increasing its earnings by orders of magnitude in the coming years. Or take Tesla, which is not yet profitable and has a market cap of $55 billion. Its competitor, Ford, recorded $2.4 billion in profit during its last fiscal quarter and has a market cap of $42 billion. So you basically have two companies of similar size. One makes lots of money, and the other doesn't, said Harris. And people are betting that Tesla is going to win. It's common for people to oscillate between optimism and pessimism for any number of reasons, Harris said. And when they do, tech firms are the worst hit because their values depend on uncertainties. Harris, an economist and USC instructor, Pei Ling Yin, believes it's what happens in the long run that matters, and the best thing to do is to ride it out. After all, even with recent fluctuations, Apple's current share price remains 24% higher at $162.48 a share than it was this time last year. And Alphabet, despite experiencing its sharpest drop in stock market price in the last 12 months last week, is still trading at 31% higher at $1,077 a share than its value a year ago. Looking more generally at investor pessimism of the stock market, Harris said the volatility could serve as a warning of the consequences of a growing federal deficit. Deficits can lead to crowding out, which is when the government competes with the private sector for a limited amount of funds to finance its deficit spending. This can then drive up interest rates, which can discourage investments, and lower investments can lead to lower economic growth. The president may not care about deficits, and Congress may not care either, but it's clear business people and investors do care, Harris said. And next, at JFK, hotelier plans to bring back glam look of 1962. Aviation has declined from the days when air travel was considered glamorous and exciting. But Tyler Morse, a hotelier planning the first hotel within walking distance of the terminals at Kennedy International Airport, is enthusiastically embracing that earlier time, specifically 1962. 62 was a special year. John Kennedy was president. John Glenn circled the earth. The space race was on, said Morse, the chief executive of MCR, a hotel owner and developer in New York. That was also the year that Trans World Airlines opened its flagship terminal at what is now JFK. Joy Kissling was a 20-year-old student at Pace University in Manhattan at the time. Some days she would drive to the airport after school dressed up for travel and just sit in the lobby. In those days, you could walk in and sit on the red cushions and watch the passengers go back and forth, she said. I love the atmosphere. Morse envisions a return to glory when the TWA hotel opens in 2019 in the old terminal. Tucked into a section of what Morse claims will be the largest hotel lobby in the world at 200,000 square feet, it will be a museum celebrating mid-century design, the dawn of the jet age, and yes, the terminal itself. Probably I'm crazy, but I love the building, Morse said. It's probably one of the most special buildings in America, and to be able to bring it back to life is a treat. Morse declined to speak about construction cost, but his budget for the project has been reported to be roughly $265 million. We've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast in our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.